The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with a simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelance profiles, get help drafting a job post, or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them to take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com today and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com. Upwork.com.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Hello, Behind the Knife listeners. We are so excited to be back with you for another Clinical Challenges in Colon and Rectal Surgery with the Leahy Colorectal Surgery team. Yet again, we have another very, very special guest who's joining us today, and we'll introduce them shortly. So I'll just recap some of our prior episodes that we talked about in case you missed them. Endoscopic management of advanced colorectal polyps, the role of total neoadjuvant therapy for locally advanced rectal cancer, surgical management of rectal prolapse, use of biologic medications in patients with Crohn's disease requiring ileocolic resections, strictureplasties in Crohn's disease, horseshoe abscesses, and anal dysplasias. Very nice smorgasbord of colorectal surgery. And so today, we're going to tackle perhaps one of the more technically challenging aspects of colorectal surgery, and that is the ileopouch anal anastomosis creation and management of complications. So once again, we have with us again, Dr. Peter West Marcello and Dr. Tess Hannah Ouellette. So say hi again.
Hey guys, it's Peter. Happy to be back on again for another episode. I just came back from the Midwest colorectal meeting in Tahoe, California. It was phenomenal. Great meeting as always, because you interact with many others. And with us, we had Dr. Matthew Much, Leahy graduate and our current ASCRS president. And I just got to tell you this, Matt is a phenomenal skier. I skied with him for 20 years. He was doing double blacks going down the chutes. So when you see the president at the national meeting, ask him, how's the skiing going?
Nice. I tried to FaceTime you guys. I tried to FaceTime you guys on the ski lift. It didn't work.
We saw it. We're like, let's go to the chute instead.
Things are good. Almost cooking 37 and a half weeks. So almost at the end of my journey here. And you'll have to do all the skiing for me this season. So get a few more.
Can you tell the listeners, is it a boy or a girl? Do we know?
It's a girl. Yeah.
Nice. Oh, congratulations. Congrats.
Thank you. Yeah, things are good though.
All right. And today we have, as I said, a very, very special guest who's going to be joining us. So I'm honored to introduce Dr. Philip Fleschner. So Dr. Fleschner is the chair in colorectal surgery at Cedars-Sinai. He completed his general surgery residency at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York City. And then he completed his colorectal fellowship at the Leahy Clinic. What was it called then?
The Leahy Clinic.
Not Hitchcock or the out. Yeah, okay. And he then took a job at Cedars-Sinai in LA and remains there to this day. And the main clinical and research interests of Dr. Fleschner are directed towards optimizing outcomes and techniques in the surgical management of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. He has over 200 publications, numerous awards throughout his illustrious career, and we are thrilled to have him join us on Behind the Knife. P, Peter, any additional comments you'd like to make about
that? Well, you know, so Phil was a fellow in 1991, and his year was like an all-star year. He had Jose Guillem, who's been on the program before, and Dr. Tom Stahl, who was down in Washington, D.C. A great year. Phil, a phenomenal surgeon, and invited me out to Cedars-Sinai and put me up at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And if you want to hear some good stories, whenever you see me, I'll give you some good stories about that. Great trip and a great innovator. And this is our understanding and thoughts regarding surgery for Crohn's in UC. So really a pleasure to have Phil on board.
Great to be here, guys. And listen, as an ex-Leahy graduate, fondest year of my surgical training by far was getting those great oatmeal cookies in the cafeteria. I don't know if they have those anymore, but those oatmeal cookies were absolutely unbelievable. To this day, I still remember them.
All right, Giles, let's get rolling.
Let's do it. All right, so like our prior clinical challenges episodes, we're just going to talk about one case, all right? And then we're going to take a deep dive about some complex medical and surgical decision-making. And so a reminder, you can follow along with us on the Behind the Knife YouTube channel for some relevant images. All right, so this is a 20-year-old male. You're seeing him in your clinic as a second opinion. He was diagnosed with medically refractory ulcerative colitis in 2019. And initially underwent a total abdominal colectomy with an ileostomy. He recovered well, and then 3 months later, he underwent takedown of the ileostomy, completion proctectomy, with a pouch rectal anastomosis. So just some details here. The rectum and operative rapport was noted to be transected at the level of the levators using an endo-GIA 60-millimeter purple cartridge stapler bicuspid. Two firings were needed to come across the rectum. The J-pouch was made from 12.5-centimeter limbs, and then a 31-millimeter EEA stapler was used for the anastomosis, no proximal diversion. All right, so let's stop there. Dr. Fleschner, if we can ask you to summarize some of your ideal approaches to how you create an ileopouch anal anastomosis in patients with medically refractory ulcerative colitis. And so I think our listeners would love to hear just your general thoughts. Two-stage, three-stage, key technical steps of the pouch creation, role of proximal fecal diversion, and then your historical perspective on how this has changed over time.
Well, historically, certainly. I mean, certainly also what I learned in Leahy, because I did a lot of them there, is we used to do these all via open incisions. I think with the advent of laparoscopy now, most of us now are doing it that way because it's less invasive and certainly easier on the patient. Many of these patients are young and it's a good cosmetic effect, cosmesis after. In terms of the procedure itself, I do laparoscopy pretty much exclusively now in these patients to try to do it. I'm a big believer of fecal diversion. I think that routine fecal diversion is important in these. And the main reason I think I say that, even though there are some people out there that tend not to do that, we can potentially talk about that. I really do believe you get one shot to do that pelvis well. And I think if you end up miscalculating, yes, it's a stoma. Yes, stomas have their own risks. And stoma closures have their own risk, and patients don't like them, et cetera. But if you gamble wrong, you literally have a lifetime of problem as opposed to 2 months of a potential problem with a stoma. So that's the reason why I generally believe in that. We routinely used to do these in two stages. Now, most of them are, quite frankly, done in three phases, mainly because of the role of biologics, although there's a lot of data out there that shows that it does not influence surgical morbidity. But I think a lot of us have sort of just become comfortable in doing it that way. I certainly will do two-stage procedures in patients who are on no medication, like dysplasia example, if they're on this, getting a colectomy for dysplasia. But I think in general, three phases now, basically what we're doing. I used to do all of my procedures using mucosectomies. I think I've changed that now. Most of them now are done double staple technique. So I do retain a small amount, but it's very important to remember that you're not going to do an ileopouch rectal anastomosis in this. And this is one of the caveats that you have to be careful of when you're doing laparoscopy, because as much as you think you're getting down to the pelvic floor and the levators, and potentially in this case, there's no way that they went out to the levators. And I can tell you that mainly because of what you said. They said they're at the levators, but yet they have to have two firings of a stapler. As all of you know, the rectum is very, very large, but it narrows down to the anal canal so that by the top of the levators, it's basically a short tube. Literally what you would think of the anus. So literally when you staple these, when you're doing your distal transection, you should be seeing a short tube, not something that requires two staplers. And beside the fact that, obviously, we all know that multiple firings on the rectum is not good because it increased leak rate, this is another problem which I think that you've sort of described in your report right here, which should be a red flag in terms of what's going to be happening to this patient.
Phil, that's a good summary. Who gets a mucosectomy now? What do you think the top three reasons that somebody might get it?
I do mucosectomy still for patients who have the pre-op diagnosis of dysplasia, particularly it's in the rectum or cancer. Obviously, if you're doing one, for example, with an upper rectal cancer where you have some ability to get below the tumor in a good way. I'll still be doing dysplasia where I have a technical problem. If I have a patient, for example, when I'm putting in the stapler and it rips through the distal side, I almost always will do it in that scenario.
Yeah,
but those are the main reasons nowadays that I'll do a two-stage. And the other thing that I do them routinely on right now, quite frankly, are the pouch revisions. The ones that have, you know, that ever, whatever they need, they have some, almost always those patients are going to have a mucosectomy and a very ultra low, if you want to call it, pouch anal anastomosis.
And I agree with 100% on the rectum transection. I think if you're going to do a double staple technique, it's got to be, you know, 1 to 2 centimeters of the cuff. I like to use still a Phaon steel incision, both for extraction, and I like the TA30 stapler across the low rectum as my preference, as my primary treatment. How do you handle the rectal stump for transection?
I totally agree with what you said. Now, in a, for example, a skinny female with a wide pelvis where you can go all the way down and you know you're at the levators and you put your finger in and it literally is like a centimeter and a half, 2 centimeters above the dentate line. I have no problem just taking a TA60 and going across that. But if you're in a scenario where even if you've had the intent to do that and you're running into a problem here, do a Phaon steel incision. You're going to end up, you know, for a Phaon steel incision, for, I keep saying, you know, you have a lot, many of these patients are young, they have their whole lives ahead of them. For a little Phaon steel incision, guys, and you get so much more ability. And I totally agree, because it sort of gets back to what I said before, the anus, the rectum, if you want to call it, at that level is very narrow, and a TA30 will go across that easily.
Tess, you're now coming 3 years of clinical practice. Tell us about your pouch experience, what you've done and what they do in the practice. And what do you think your recent grads need to know who are coming out of fellowship about that? And what about the role of diversion?
So I have not had a ton of experience. I have been able to do a few in my first few years of practice. My first year at UMass, worked with Dr. Makel as a clinical associate, and we were able to do quite a few together. At UMass, we are doing quite a bit of TA-TME and have kind of utilized this approach for the second stage completion proctectomy. And I think in terms of what we're kind of getting at, the benefit of the TA-TME is you're able to really define that distal transection of the rectum using the transanal approach to fight some of the challenges that we're kind of describing in that narrow male pelvis, where you're not really, the angle of a stapler might be challenging if you're trying to do it laparoscopically. Obviously, coming from Leahy, I love a Phaon steel and the TA-30, as you already brought up, Dr. Marcello. But that's one of the things at UMass that I think I didn't see as much of as a fellow, and I think does definitely have its benefits. There's different sizes to the transanal platform, so you don't want to pick the biggest size because you want to make sure that you're actually getting that short rectal cuff and not leaving a long stump with the transanal platform. And so you can also, depending on the platform, I've seen some of my partners like trim it afterwards too if you need to get a little bit lower, but then you're really set up for a good transanal view of everything. I 100% believe in diversion. I think there's a theme here, everybody from Leahy, but I think one of the things that stuck with me as a fellow, Dr. Marcello, is you kind of hammering home this idea of the creation of a pouch being quality of life operation. And, you know, we get one shot, as Dr. Fleschner has already pointed out. And so we want to do it well. And we know that from a lot of the literature, pouches that suffer a leak have higher rates of failure, quality of life and function is not as good. And so if we're doing this to give patients the best quality of life and function, why gamble with that? And so far my stance is divert with an ileostomy for that reason.
All right, so let's continue with the case. And so as you can probably tell from our conversation and based on our prior cases, the story is not going to end with a perfect pouch trichal anastomosis. So unfortunately, this patient did have a fairly poor pouch function, was having at least 15 bowel movements per day, up multiple times at night. And so now he's seeing you in clinic 6 months after his pouch creation. Like we said, second opinion. You do a pouchoscopy yourself, and that reveals a fairly long rectal cuff at about 5 centimeters from the dentate line. And there's severe inflammation with erosions and ulcerations in the rectal cuff. You know, the pouch itself is normal. And so again, we just remind you, if you want to follow along with YouTube, you'll see some endoscopic images of the rectal cuff here. So Dr. Fleschinger, how do you approach a patient like this who shows up at your clinic, both medically and surgically?
Well, one of the first things I would do, like I just mentioned before, is go to the upper port, because this is going to give you clues as to what happened. That's number one. Number two, obviously, you see this. So this is basically an incomplete proctectomy. This is basically still residual colitis. And I presume the patient was severe enough, obviously, to require a colectomy. Obviously, their inflammation was bad enough that they went to surgery. You can throw medication until the cows come home on this. This needs surgery. And there's really no other way to get around this. You're going to have to go back in that pelvis. You're going to have to take out the residual rectum and perform an ileopouch anal, not ileopouch rectal like this is, an ileopouch anal anastomosis. And that's what I would recommend in this patient.
Yeah, I agree. I think here the goal is you got to get rid of that diseased piece. And that's what we talked about. I didn't think that medical therapy would be a benefit. And then he was a young male. So am I going to try double staple if I can, depending on what happens, or mucosectomy, and that'll be an intraop decision making.
All right, great. So let's come to the operating room 9 months after his prior surgery for exploratory laparotomy lysis adhesions. We took down the pouch rectal anastomosis. Anastomosis did a completion proctectomy and then constructed an ileopouch anal anastomosis with diverting loop ileostomy. I guess, Peter, maybe you want to give some comments then about intraoperative findings and some of your thoughts when you were doing the case.
Yeah, I'll ask Bill the same thing, but before I make a pouch, I just start with a flexible endoscopy in the OR. Like right there, I'm making my decision. Am I going to do a double staple or a mucosectomy? And it really is on the state of that distal 2 centimeters of the rectal cuff. And while there was inflammation, I thought the cuff would be acceptable for stapling anastomosis. And so that was part of it. And then, of course, we'll talk about leak testing, which if I'm going to do a double staple, I'm going to leak test it. And so I got rid of the disease part and took the rest out. Phil, how do you decide if you're going to do a mucosectomy or a stapled? Are there factors?
I would have done a mucosectomy in this patient. And the main reason why is that this patient, and again, it's not exactly a cuff, but it's a long cuff. And they've kind of declared themselves that they're going to continue to have inflammation in the residual cuff that you're leaving. So I would be very inclined to do a full mucosectomy in this patient, bring it down, get all of that mucosa out, because he's already defined his natural history, I think, to some degree. So I would do an ileopouch anal mucosectomy with a diverting loop ileostomy.
Well, I wish I had listened to you, Phil. Go ahead.
All right. So he was discharged home on post-op day 7. He was then readmitted with fevers and abdominal pain. So I'll show you just a screenshot of the CT scan that showed a likely pelvic hematoma, some air adjacent to this. So we took him back to the operating room, wash out of a pelvic hematoma, and then pouchoscopy. We did find old hematoma in the pelvis, no gross purulence. On the short rectal cuff side posteriorly, the mucosa had separated slightly at the staple line, but there's really no definitive true opening in the posterior midline. And so at that time, he sort of felt that it was possible there might have been a small breach at the anastomosis. And so we placed a 24 French Malakut into the pouch and then transabdominal drains anterior and posterior to the pouch. Comments then, Peter, about some of your thoughts?
I'll ask Phil about his thoughts. He was very sick. I mean, he was toxic. So I felt that I didn't think that non-operative management with percutaneous drainage was appropriate. And I saw this, the big collection, he was sick. And I wanted to make sure I could do the best I could to try to salvage pouch. So I elected to reopen. I explored, washed things out, and then found the defect posteriorly. And in this scenario, what I learned from the past was communicate the abdominal and the transanal cavities. In other words, leave a malakut in from above and put a drain from below that the two communicate together so that you try to create one natural cavity rather than sometimes drains, it'll be off to the side and not to the malancot. So that's what we did. Put a 24 malancot, did our drains, closed them up, and let them recover.
Yeah, I mean, my perspective on this is that this is an unusual scenario for someone who has a posterior leak like this, in other words, to be so sick. The vast majority of these get walled off. Yeah, the patient has some fever. Usually they'll just present, I feel like I have a golf ball in my pelvis. And you're kind of wondering what's going on. They don't have to have fever. They don't have to have a white count. Because most of them, at least in my experience, have an ileostomy. So I agree if the patient was sick, the patient needed a washout, obviously. Again, you also have to remember that you're probably going to manipulate the pouch a little bit and pull on it, potentially make that leak that you have, that defect, a little bit larger. So you have to be careful with that. And I understand, I understand the concept. I know some people try to do this abdominal pelvic communication, but it seems to me like doing an IR drain with a transgluteal, or even quite frankly, a transanal drain, where you're keeping endoluminal, might be potentially better. But again, I have there's no trials looking at that. My approach to this.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. My approach to this. Yeah, okay. Sick, you need to go to OR.
But they're not sick. I mean, that's the majority.
Majority.
So the message to the residents is, if they're not that sick, IR drainage or transanal drainage.
Yes, I do agree with that. That's what I'd be doing. But again, a sick patient, listen, any sick patient, you go to the OR, okay? And you can't rely on IR. IR is good, but they're not that good in a patient who's otherwise septic, of course.
So, yeah, he definitely recovered well from that operation. And then prior to discharge, we did do a repeat exam under anesthesia. We did confirm a small posterior pouch anal anastomotic leak, about 3 to 4 millimeters in diameter. We were able to place a 10 French catheter into this cavity. And so again, if you're following along, you can see the defect on our presentation. So Dr. Fleshner, going forward for a patient like this, what's your game plan? How do you talk about it with the patient? What the next steps are?
Well, certainly the drain in place will obviously keep him well. One of the things that I would consider doing this is to enlarge it a little bit with a balloon and then to put an endo sponge in there. I've had some experience doing that. You know, the endo sponges, unfortunately, are not available commercially in this country. You kind of have to rig it yourself with an NG tube and the vac drain that all of us know about in wounds. And the concept is basically you have to bring it. It's very labor intensive, guys. Don't get me wrong. You have to bring the patient back every 3 to 4 days for a back change. You can't just do this at the bedside. It's anesthesia, et cetera. But it's an attempt to try to collapse the cavity. And there's some European data that suggests that the functional results might be better this way than doing an IR drain. But again, that's one thing to consider doing in this scenario, if you'd already done the transanal drain. Most of the time, though, although I have experience with endosponges, most of the time I'll just leave the drain in, keep it in for about 3 to 4 weeks, and then slowly advance it out and end up leaving yourself a sinus, which you can then evaluate after that, either radiologically and or again with another scope, to see whether or not you should incorporate this into the pouch and basically take that leak that he has and basically make it one cavity. But that's something you'll decide down the line. But you don't do that right away because there's, you know, you need this thing to mature and develop a fibrotic wall around it first.
Got it. So we ended up taking him a couple weeks later for an exam under anesthesia, and we were able to perform a transanal closure of the anastomotic leak. And so good vascularity of the tissue, you know, no evidence of obvious Crohn's at that point. I guess, Peter, your thoughts, and you describe your technique for our listeners about how you approach that.
Yeah, I want to go back to a second for Phil for the endo sponge. So basically, you put a sponge in, put an NG tube in, suck on the sponge coming out, and then change it in less sponge each time.
Yeah, right? Supposedly, I mean, it contracts. The space contracts.
It's just an anal vac is basically what we're talking about. Yeah, I think the residents understand that concept. Here, and for those listeners who have YouTube and can see the image, it was actually quality tissue, and I still had the abdominal drain in. So we've had experience here where we actually will try to suture it. And the tricks of the trade for suturing it is we use those plastic anoscopes that we used to have way back from Leahy. There's a company in New Orleans that will make them. And I used a laparoscopic needle driver. And I used a couple of Trio Vicryl on an RB needle. And I was able to drive through to bring the tissue together, knowing that it's not perfectly sealed. And I still have the abdominal drain for any fluid that I want to collect on the other side. And this case, as you can see in the image, it didn't really favor itself to that sinus that you often see where there's sort of a longer erosion. It would look more like a flap. So I just closed the flap.
It's interesting how you did it down the line. I'm wondering why you didn't consider doing it right away at the time here, if you'd already had an abdominal drain.
I thought that I wasn't sure if everything was going to settle down, and I wanted to make him in better shape and let things soften a little bit, but get there before it gets too fibrotic, right? I mean, that's the hard phase when the fibrosis sets in.
So we did perform a water-soluble enema 6 weeks later. It did still reveal a persistent leak at the anastomosis. You know, we then actually repeated this procedure 2 months later with an additional transanal repair. And so I guess at second repair, other comments about what you're looking for in terms of the tissue, Peter, to guide your operative decision-making at that time?
It's just really quality of tissue when I did the study, I was concerned that if I left it, the sinus was long, and I worry about that happening behind. But I know Phil's got a huge experience managing the leaks in the sinuses. So Phil, give us some of your thoughts and philosophies regarding a standard posterior abscess, leak, drainage, about the sinus and your thoughts regarding the sinus.
Yeah, sure. By the way, I don't have a huge experience. The only leaks I ever see are other people's patients, to not mind. So chill. Just so everyone's clear.
I know that to be true. Go ahead.
Just so everyone's clear about that. Well, I think the key is what you're saying is that obviously once you have drainage, in my experience, when I'll do a gastric, like a pyetrogram at this patient, potentially to start closing, what I'm looking for is number one, what the patient's symptoms are like. Okay. If the patient's asymptomatic and the CT scan, which you'll hopefully have as well, reveals no evidence of residual cavity space or infection behind it, I'll close it. And we've actually published on this to show that it's safe and the patients do okay down the line. But the key is that they have to be asymptomatic, okay? And the concept, the reason that we think that works is that it's walled off and it's basically just sitting there like a blind space. And if it's been there for a month or two or whatever, then you could just close it at that point. The other thing that's very helpful to look at on your pyetrogram is the anatomy of the leak. And what I mean by that it's the angle that it takes. If it takes a 90-degree angle off and it goes directly posteriorly, those are the ones that are very difficult to manage. And those are the ones that I will clearly wait and see what happens. The ones that are parallel to the pouch, literally, you could just take an endo GIA and literally slip it right through there and incorporate that defect that you have into the pouch itself to basically marsupialize it, you know, basically into the J-pouch. So that's another option to consider with the ones that are parallel to the pouch. You can't do that on the ones that are perpendicular to the pouch anal anastomosis because obviously there's so much tissue in between. But the ones that are parallel, you can. That's why it's very important that you do a pouchogram on these, not only to sense, you know, whether or not the thing is healed, but also the local anatomy to try to guide out, to guide therapy.
Yeah, so we're, go ahead, John.
And I was going to say, I mean, we've made it very, very clear to our listeners, we're talking about posterior leaks. So perhaps I can just ask Tess if we can just comment for a minute about anterior leaks. And so how is that different, better, worse for the patient, the surgeon? So I'll just put another picture here of a screenshot of a patient who's 6 months after pouch creation and ileostomy and ostomy closure. And now this patient's presenting with pelvic pain. So female, pelvic pain, fever, and anterior leak. So Tess, what are your thoughts about a patient like that?
Yeah. So the male, you have the prostate there. In the female, you have the vagina, uterus. This slide on the screen shows a collection anterior to the pouch, as you mentioned, with the vagina is going to be right in front of there. So ideally, you kind of drain this, depending on how sick the patient is or how they're doing, probably with IR, try to get that cavity to collapse down and hopefully you're not going to end up with a, pouch to vaginal fistula. So anyone with a pouch and you're concerned about anterior leak, making sure you really have that pelvic sepsis controlled, make sure you're looking for an abscess. And if they're having symptoms, really investigate that before you have a, big cavity and tons of inflammation sitting in that anterior cul-de-sac that's going to cause problems.
And in my experience, I'm sorry, Peter, I didn't interrupt. In my experience, the anterior leaks are very rare. We see them, but they're very uncommon. And I'm not sure why they occur, because it's certainly not a tension issue and it's not an ischemic issue, which is why the vast majority of leaks that we see are posteriorly related to the two factors I mentioned. So I quite frankly think it's going to be very difficult to get IR access into this safely because of the, what said with respect to the vagina and the prostate. I think this is exactly the one that you want to do a transanal drain, keep it in place, and then probably maybe do sort of what you did, Peter, a couple of weeks later, sew it in. And the vast majority of these, because they're not ischemic and because they're not in detention, these do very, very well, way better than the posterior ones because of the reasons I mentioned.
Yeah, I think the part of it also is the fact that there isn't that dead space. Like when you make a pouch anal anastomosis, there's always that space behind in the sacral hollow, and that's where the posterior leaks occur. An anterior leak, you've got at least vagina or prostate, like you've got tissue around it that will actually help. So I agree with you. I think if I can get good drainage, most anterior leaks, I'll make sure they're diverted. They're fine. But Tess, what about a top of the J pouch leak? That's a different one, like a different beast, but that's sort of the third category. What are your thoughts about top of the J pouch leak and what do you do there?
Yeah. So again, that's going to potentially, I think, be a little bit easier to drain transabdominally. You're going to have a harder time dealing with that transanally, I would think. And making sure that the patient's diverted, potentially, you know, source control, and then whether or not that closes down might need a revision prior to reversal.
Bill, have you seen
top
of the J?
I've seen the tip of the J leaks. I don't know why they occur. I don't know if it's our stitching or the, who knows, localized ischemia. But one of the things that's really good for these is endoscopic clipping. This is exactly the patient where it might work very well. Some of our IR, I'm sorry, our advanced GI guys actually even sew them endoluminally. And as Tess said, almost because I divert all these patients, you have the luxury, so to speak, of not having stool going by it. That's the best way to try to approach these initially. And if it doesn't work, then you got to go back in transabdominally and close that leak. And almost always it's very easy to close, but particularly in the laparoscopy age where kind of there's minimal adhesion formation, you can do it laparoscopically, but almost always I'll approach those at least endoluminally first.
That's a great teaching point.
Got it. Well, I'll just circle back around to the main case that we presented, and I'm thrilled to report a subsequent water-soluble enema showed no posterior leak. We reversed his ostomy. As you might have caught, this was actually back in 2019, 2020. And so he was seen, you know, a few years post-op and was quite well, about 8 to 10 bowel movements a day, good control. So happy end to that story.
But you'll notice that he doesn't have 4 to 6 bowel movements like you should have had if you didn't develop pelvic sepsis, although you basically you got rid of the permanent stoma potentially. But as we all know, pelvic sepsis is not good for long-term function as well.
Yeah. Here, you know, pouch leak, you know, is it can be a problem. And I think if we talk about Schatz, you know, Tess said before about the operation, Schatz always, Dr. David Schatz, mentor for Phil and I, would say that the pouch operation is an operation of functional preference. And his other favorite saying was, it's a calculated risk. We make all the calculations and the patient is taking all the risk.
I remember those very, very well.
Yeah. And they're good teaching points.
Great teaching points.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know that you'll find a 30-minute episode with more pearls in that. So I think this was awesome. So we are out of time. And so we're going to wrap up as we usually do with some of our takeaways. So Tess, give us some Tess's teaching points.
Yeah. So leaks, we've talked about result in decreased function of the pouch. So do everything you can to improve function and divert. And then these can be challenging cases. So early on in your career, you know, ask for help and make sure you have a friend close by.
All right. Marcella's must knows.
All right. A lot of must knows. Make a pouch anal anastomosis, not a pouch rectal anastomosis, most importantly for function. Posterior leaks, drain, and then manage. And I think if you do it appropriately, you can salvage many of them, but it's complicated. So if you repair and divert, and the best time is the first time to make a pouch. Phil, anything else from you?
No, I think these are very complicated procedures. Please don't do one or two a year of these. These should be sent to referral centers. If you see patients like this in the middle of the night with ulcerative colitis, it's perforated. Obviously don't do a pouch. Do your total colectomy in the middle and send them off to a referral center if you don't feel comfortable doing it. Because as everyone said, these can be very complicated procedures.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just throw in there for my approach. I mean, I'm 1 year ahead of tests, right? And so we want to get experience. We want to be doing the pouches. And so, you know, but I would say don't hesitate as in your early in your career, ask for help from a senior partner. And then if you are going to reoperate, and this is pouch, leak, no leak, I think having a partner there to evaluate complications with you is actually quite helpful. And I am saying that for personal experience because I do have complications. All right.
Well, I don't.
Great, Phil.
All right. With that, we're going to wrap up. This is our 9th episode. So again, if you like diving into the weeds, consider joining us Sunday evenings for our colorectal surgery virtual education series. And you can also check out our show notes for some details. We're going to see you again in September. And we're going to have a journal club review on diverticulitis. And please, if you enjoyed this session, do take a minute or two out of your hectic day and leave us a review. And as Behind the Knife always says, until the next time, everybody.
Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.